We left the shaman at 3:30 in the morning and started hiking in the dark toward the death slabs. The name alone should have tipped us off, but we were riding on Dean's confidence in our skills, so we didn't even think twice. In the darkness, our headlamps cast just enough beam to illuminate our immediate area, which helped quiet Jerker's fears of falling over the edge. If you can't see it, it can't hurt you. We scrambled up easy yet serious third and fourth class terrain, connecting steep sections rigged with fixed lines, often old, sun-baked ropes tied off to trees or pre-drilled bolts. We negotiated massive jumbled boulders that eventually led to a particularly steep and long section of vertical, water-polished rock. There were a couple of knotted lines dangling down from the inky black rock faces. A skeptical and sketched Jerker looked up at the ropes, then to Dean, and finally to me, and told us that he was beginning to understand why this approach is called the Death Slabs. Dean assumed that since Jerker was a world-class athlete, this would be no problem. But he's not a technical rock climber, and here he was scrambling up steep, wet, fifth-class slabs. He was also wearing worn-out running shoes that probably had 500 miles on them. It had been a long winter, and there were more than a few spots where the snow still accumulated on narrow stone ledges. Ice-cold water was running down the face and seeping underfoot. Jerker didn't complain, but we could tell he was struggling. He had been carrying all of my gear so that I could save my energy for the climb, always the night. But I insisted I take my pack for this stretch, and he reluctantly handed it over. He muscled his way up the first 50 feet of terrain, hanging on to the wet, tattered ropes with white knuckles. If you're not comfortable slab climbing, you'll tend to not trust your feet and overgrip with your hands. This means your arms rapidly fatigue. Before the final lip, Jerker's arms were completely pumped. About 15 feet off the narrow ledge, his feet slipped out from under him and his body went slack. He was dangling like a rag doll by his arms. Freezing cold water was streaming underneath him. Dean sprang into action and hand-over-handed the same rope as Scott, and when he was just below him, he yelled, "Whatever you do, do not let go." Then he gave a do-or-die command. "Put your feet on my shoulders now!" Jerker couldn't even look down. He was gripped with fear. Dean reached up with one arm and grabbed Scott's feet and placed one on each of his shoulders. Then Dean pulled his body up on the rope, raising Jerker up a few feet. But Dean saw that Scott was losing his grip. Dean moved higher up the rope and put his head right under Jerker's bottom and hoisted him up with his head. Scott reached for the ledge and managed to slide his whole body onto it, like a beached whale. He was completely soaked through and shaking. Dean and I quickly scampered up and helped Jerker move away from the cliffs. We tried to downplay it, but later Dean told me it was about as close as he'd ever seen someone get to dying. For the Dark Wizard to say that freaked me out. Dean and I climbed the face of Half Dome in just over 10 hours. That was fast for somebody of my moderate ability, but Jerker was carrying our hiking shoes and extra clothes, so we were able to go super light. Scott hiked up to the Half Dome Trail and then took the John Muir Trail 8 miles down to the valley floor, staying safe on terra firma. He bought us sweet drinks and salty snacks and then quickly turned around and hiked back up to meet us at the summit. I was spoiled, I know, but that's the kind of guy Jerker is. We all hiked down together, laughing and reliving the death slabs. All told, Scott hiked 35 miles that day. 4 years later, the image of the late great Dean Potter's head, almost literally up Jerker's ass, was still engraved in my mind. So I was grateful Timmy, an experienced climber, was going to be with Jerker through the White Mountains.
Chapter 12. For Mud. Day 33. Horty's mountaintop prophecies about the challenges of Vermont began to manifest themselves immediately after I crossed over from Massachusetts on day 33. "Vermont can be real nasty," he'd warned me. It was even nastier than that. The storm that had rocked us to sleep on top of Mount Greylock must have roared its way north in the night, because as soon as I descended and crossed the border, I ran into mud pits unlike anything I had ever seen. Pools of muck pitted the trail so frequently and expanded so quickly, it was often hard to tell where the trail was. A lot of it was underwater, submerged beneath a soup of rocks, leaves, and wind debris. It seemed more like a stream bed than a trail. It would end up being Vermont's wettest June in 300 years. Horty, in his many trips to Vermont, had never seen it this bad.
"Vermont's usually bad, but this is unreal," he said. "Usually it's runnable section, runnable section, muddy section. Right now it's muddy section, runnable section."
Thru-hikers call the state Vermud, and it's a joke among locals up there that there are four seasons in Vermont. Mud, 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 and mud. I think that's probably unfair to winter, when the mud freezes solid under a layer of snow. But it was otherwise accurate in my experience there. The mud wasn't just messy, it became a real obstacle. Forward progress slowed to a crawl. Each mile took longer to cover, and the mud sucked more and more energy out of me. Everyone knows the feeling of accidentally stepping into muck and not knowing where the bottom lies. Just imagine that, but for miles and miles and miles. Every step ended in a cold splash, and then the next required me to pull my back foot up and out of the sticky grip of the trail. My shoes filled with the sludge and suction to the bottom. It was awful. It was like running with weighted boots and in high gravity. Horty told us that the bedrock was so close to the surface of the trail that the mire had nowhere to go and just floated on top. Trail maintenance was impossible. I could do nothing but wallow along and laugh at how ridiculous the conditions were. Perhaps to keep my mind off the here and now, Horty went over the Vermont game plan once again as we slogged through the endless muck. The next 100 miles of the AT would track the gnarled spine of the Green Mountains, and the following 50 miles would veer eastward, crossing against the grain of those same mountains, and resulting in many sharp climbs, descents, and likely a lot of falls. It was a real pick-your-poison stretch of the trail, and I looked forward to putting Vermud in my rearview mirror when we got to higher ground in New Hampshire. One reason this part of the country was so weather-worn was that it was by far the oldest stretch of the whole AT. For 105 miles, it runs with the Long Trail, which was created well before the AT, back in 1910, by men with handsaws, axes, and shovels. It took 20 years to finish the 272-mile footpath, which stretches from Vermont's southern border all the way to Canada. And it was the first major recreational trail in America. So it had vintage charm and storied mystique. It was also kind of like one long, sludge-filled wheel rut. Horty knew whereof he spoke. He'd established a Long Trail FKT of 4 days and 2 hours back in 1999. It was also up here that he'd overtaken his rival, Scott Maniac Grierson, during their mano-a-mano duel along the AT. After 1,606 miles of chasing each other north, Maniac tried to throw Horty off in this stretch by listing the wrong time when he signed in at the registers at the start of the day, an attempt to make it look like he was far ahead. It worked at first, and Horty was devastated, until he got to a register where Maniac had mistakenly signed in on the following day. Later, he saw someone coming out of the Congdon shelter, and he knew it had to be Maniac. He told me that he'd been fantasizing about that moment since he'd found out about the deception, and he had planned to say,
"Guess who I am? Your worst nightmare."
But in reality, he just said hello, and he and Maniac walked 6 miles together. They played leapfrog for the next 3 days, trading the lead back and forth, until Horty left him for good I think Horty liked toying with his prey. Around midday, with almost comically bad timing, a local runner found me and proceeded to extol the virtues of wearing Urachi sandals while running the Vermont trails of mud. As someone who had Urachis handmade for him by a Tarimaran in the Copper Canyon, I laughed. What is this guy talking about? You could have worn snow boots or socks out there, and it wouldn't have mattered. The mud would suction your feet down just the same. Nothing was going to help me get through this muck, except one shoe-sucking step at a time. I'd been feeling great in the last stretch of Massachusetts, and had entertained the thought that maybe I'd turn the last corner and was going to bolt into Maine just like old times, old races. The muck ended my optimism quickly. More disruptive than the mud, I was beginning to feel the first real effects of sleep deprivation. There were moments when I was all but hallucinating. I'd been running for 33 days, and for most of those days, my eyes had been on the trail and the passing ground, scanning for obstacles. I'd spent hundreds of hours and hundreds of miles like that, my eyes fixed downward, watching half-focused, taking in the endless procession of rocks and roots and ruts that streamed past. Every once in a while, I'd look up at Walter or Jalu, or just toward a white blaze. Instead of the solid real world, I'd see a strange waterfall world, everything streaming toward me, everything falling down. I wondered if I would see anything but the passing trail for the rest of my life. Walter snapped me back to reality. He was steady, strong, and cheerful. On the trail, he talked about how beautiful everything was, and how great it was being outside, hanging out. He talked about how nice it would feel to have dinner later, to stretch out. Walter never once complained to me. He was a stoic on the trail. I didn't know how miserable he was. Later he told me, "I kept having to bite my tongue because it was so heinous, but I couldn't complain to you because I'd only been out there 3 days." As the gray dark sky faded to the black of night on day 33, Walter and I ran past some thru-hikers at the Goddard Shelter, below the rainy summit of Glastonbury Mountain in Vermont, and I felt desperately envious of the warm sleeping bags they were curled up in. But we still had 13 more mountainous miles to go before our day was over. Chilled to our bones in the steady downpour and silent from our muddy efforts, Walter and I finally reached Castle Black at 11 p.m. in the shadow of Stratton Mountain. The alarm went off the morning of day 34, but I was sure I was dreaming. It felt like I was swimming or diving or drowning. As I shook myself awake, I realized I wasn't any of those things, but I was definitely wet. Had I accidentally lost control of my bladder in the middle of the night? Then I saw Jalu. She was looking at me with an odd expression. I was in bed, in Castle Black, but there was no doubt about it. I was soaked. After a quick inspection, we surmised that I had been sweating in my sleep a lot. Neither of us knew why, but it felt like a lingering virus from a couple days back. Or was it the beginnings of Lyme disease? It was a new development, and an unwelcome one. Jalu insisted on giving me a thorough examination, and she got more and more worried as she looked me over. My ribs were visible, my eyes were bulging, and I was covered with a mysterious red bumpy rash. Not to mention I still reeked of vinegar, but that was no mystery. The vinegar scent was a byproduct of metabolizing amino acids and the protein in my muscles. I was literally cannibalizing myself. Even though I was eating upwards of 7,000 calories a day and plenty of carbohydrates, I was dangerously tapping into my essential reserves. Being on my feet for sometimes 20 hours a day meant I was always at the edge of gnawing away at my own muscle, muscle I was going to need for the larger mountains ahead. As I stumbled up out of Castle Black, the weight of sleep deprivation hit me like a humid day. It was dense. My legs were heavy. I needed to be like an alchemist and turn my lead feet into golden wings. But I was moving and thinking too slowly for any magic, and my morning routine seemed to pass me in a series of stills. I lost track of things, and only had time to eat a banana and grab some Clif Bars to go. There was one piece of excellent news that day, something that I'd been looking forward to for weeks. Timmy O'Neill, our good friend from Boulder, was scheduled to arrive that day. With Walter already with us, it meant that I was going to push through Vermud with close friends on my wing. Timmy was definitely unlike the other friends and fellow ultrarunners who had joined me so far. For starters, he wasn't even a runner. He'd never done anything like 50 miles a day before. I'm sure the only times he ran was from the police as a kid and from commitment as an adult. He'd been assuring both Jenny and me for months of his excitement, claiming that he'd even been training with extended solo climbs in the Flatirons above Boulder. He loved trying new things, declaring that once he found what he was really good at, he did it as little as possible in order to continually develop his discomfort zone. He was also hilarious, a stand-up comic, and had made a career expressing the droll side of adventure sports. He had outdoor chops. He was a Patagonia and Clif Bar-sponsored climber, but I was most looking forward to his spirit and sense of humor. He lived with virtually no material possessions, deciding instead to purchase them for others, a house for his mom and a car for his brother. He read a book a week, and he said he would rather help a friend through a divorce than go to the wedding, because everyone will help you party, but few will help you grieve. He and Jenny were friends from way back, and I knew that she had turned to him whenever she went through a difficult breakup. There had been a few. On the trail, he was all smiles when he greeted us, and he told me that he felt great, even though he'd been roofied backstage at a concert the night before. I didn't ask for more details. There were plenty of miles ahead for that story. I just shook my head and said that it was awesome to have him out here with us. As we headed north, the Green Mountains seesawed up and down endlessly along an eternal ridge. The mud was bad, but it would have been hard running even after a long dry spell. This was some of the most jumbled up country I'd been on yet, thick with rocks that seemed glued together by mud and grass. Making our way forward meant constantly having to seek out stable places, lunging, torquing, twisting. Every surface of my body came into contact with the trail. The storm hadn't helped. Many of the downed trees still had fresh white wood where they'd been broken by the wind, which was still whipping around in gusts of 55 miles an hour. The Stratton area was beautiful and one of the more inspiring points of the whole trail. It's renowned for its great skiing, but I was most enraptured by the quiet loveliness of its fire tower. These towers used to dot the national forests everywhere, especially out west, where they'd rise up several stories in the air and terminate in a small covered platform. There, a diligent and self-possessed fire watcher would spend a few months of the year looking for the telltale signs of wildfires. If any were spotted, he or she would leap into action and send coordinates of the inchoate blaze to administrators, who would send out firefighters. Most of these towers had been decommissioned and deconstructed, but a few remain. The tower on Stratton had been renovated, and its caretakers were an old French-Canadian couple who seemed so happy, so at peace with their little perch in the sky, that I immediately hoped that Jaylu and I could be like them one day. They reminded me that atop this tower, Benton McKay first conceived of the idea for the Appalachian Trail. I wished I could have stayed and tapped into their wisdom and cheer more. But after signing my book for them, I was back in the white blazed track of muck. I was mentally foggy all that day, and happy to listen to Timmy and Walter tell stories that had nothing to do with running, records, or mud. I started to slip into a comfortable mode in which I deferred decision-making mostly to them, or to the crew more generally. It was easier than weighing options and making judgment calls. The weeks of little sleep had accumulated, and I was finally starting to notice the difficulties that it brought. And yet, there were still moments every day when I felt a sense of certainty that I was in exactly the right place, doing the right thing at the right time. I wanted it to end, but I already knew I'd miss it when it did. That night, bruised and beaten, We stayed in a hotel in North Clarendon, a little town just past the Green Mountains. Horty had booked the rooms and thought we should all get a night indoors. It had been a wet 9 days since the last real roof I'd slept under. I woke up on the morning of day 35 and realized that I had a little over 10 days to go if I wanted to break the record. Close enough to begin to seem urgent. Close enough to seem possible. For the first few weeks on the trail, I'd wake up craving more sleep, but I'd also feel like I'd rebounded from the night before. My body was still finding ways to re-knit its tears and heal all the damage I'd loaded onto it. That started to change in Vermont. Whether it was a physical tipping point and whether sleep was a factor, I didn't know. But the feeling was undeniable. I was losing a piece of myself every day now. I wasn't recuperating overnight. Horty had a theory about motivation. He told me that a lot of motivation could be boiled down to this. How bad do you want it? He would ask people, "What's the furthest you can run without stopping?" After they replied whatever distance, he followed up with, "Could you run a mile further if I gave you $1 million? What if I was running behind you, holding a gun to your head? Could you run even farther?" He said, "It's easy to say you want it real bad when you're sitting at home on the couch. But when the going gets tough, do you want it enough?" We often think we can't go any farther and feel like we have nothing left to give. Yet there is a hidden potential and strength in all of us, begging us to find it. We arrive at it via different means, sometimes reward, sometimes fear. There was something to Horty's motivational theory, and finding that desire was the most vexing problem. How bad did I want it? The question became less and less theoretical in Vermont, where I started to come up against my own limits. I've heard it said that ultramarathons are 90% mental, and the other 10%? That's mental too. I was in the thick of that other 10%. About two-thirds of the way through day 35, I began to worry that Timmy might break before I did. He kept stopping to stretch his legs, especially his calves and ankles. The marathon distance yesterday, coupled with the 40 miles he'd done today, ruined him. It seemed likely to me that he had a condition common among distance runners called Achilles tendinosis, compounded with gross effusion, which he prosaically called his cankles. He was done for the night, and maybe for his entire tour. At the first meeting point in the mountains, Jaylu and I huddled up. Timmy's overuse injury didn't only complicate his life, but we had been counting on him to help us get through the White Mountains coming up next in New Hampshire. He wasn't a runner, but he covered challenging terrain like a mountain goat and could have helped me navigate the most technical sections. It was raining again. In fact, it had been raining ever since that storm overtook us at Greylock, and it seemed like we'd been caught in one continuous torment ever since we'd left Springer Mountain on day one. I could probably count on the fingers of one hand the number of days it hadn't rained in the past month. Timmy had had to bow out, and the skies had opened up even wider, and I was starting to have those visions again, the ones where the world rushed by even when I was standing still. At one point, the trail began to plummet almost vertically, serving as a kind of funnel for all the millions of gallons of water falling on Vermont that day. The deluge turned the trail into a stream and then into a ditch. My body was so used to bending over and seeking out safe spots for my feet, I was constantly pitching forward and sliding and bruising the same areas over and over. With Timmy sidelined, Mark Fatboy Godale surprised us for the night shift, driving 9 hours straight from Cleveland in a car that appeared to contain all of his possessions, children's car seats and items from his four daughters, running gear and shoes, a potpourri of trash, and selected items for this trip, including a folding lawn chair he planned to set up for sleeping inside his car. The car and its contents were like his current life situation. Everything was within arm's reach, but nothing was useful. A recent divorce had left Godale hobbling mentally as much as he was physically, due to his numerous injuries and surgeries. He needed this quick trip to the AT as much as I needed him for the night shift. Over his 25 years of running ultras and setting records, he had seen a lot, but I don't think he knew what he was getting into. He didn't care. Fat boy always had the right attitude. By nightfall, I was holding on by a thread mentally. I asked Fat Boy why there was a house lit up on the top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere. He laughed and told me that it was the moon rising behind the ridgeline of trees, not a house. I didn't have the energy to care what was reality. And yet, I was still moving forward. My decades of running had trained my brain in ways that I hadn't even anticipated. It was triaging itself, shutting off certain systems to allow others to keep going. Above all, my legs, my lungs. Fat Boy and I staggered on into the night. It seemed like we passed one perfectly fine stopping point after another, and somehow Horty was there at each one, waving us on, telling us to keep going, to stay on schedule and get 50 miles in today, keeping track of some master plan known only to him. I was too tired to stop. The path of least resistance was in front of me, and that path kept going until 2:30 a.m. Jalu had to keep driving miles out of her way to accommodate Horty's extended stopping points. The final stop that night was at single car wide Joe Ranger Road. She found the best parking place available for Castle Black. It felt like it was on about a 20-degree slope, and I spent much of the night at the edge of the bed, clinging to Jalu so I didn't roll off. It didn't matter. We could sleep like babies anywhere by this point. I felt bad for Fat Boy, who was trying to sleep reclined in the driver's seat of his car while pitched downhill. In the morning, Horty slid open the van door with his usual greeting, but I thought I could hear some doubt and sadness in his customary, "Let's go to Maine, boy." We ignored him and tried to go back to sleep, since we'd only gotten a few hours of sleep the previous night. It was pouring outside. I told him I wasn't getting out this early, even if he was leaving today. I was completely annihilated. Horty came back 10 minutes later. "I know this is really hard, and you've been barely getting any sleep, but you better get on the trail. Come on, boy. I'll join you to the next road crossing." Like a father trying to coax his teenage son out of bed, Horty got my pack ready. I asked him if he could wash out my shoes, which would give me some bit of comfort. He did. He went out to a muddy creek along the roadside. I saw him briefly swirl my shoes in the water and call it good. I was touched that he did it, though I don't think he actually got any mud out of them. It was day 36, July 1st, and it was going to rain every day until the end of the world. It was really testing my faith in Horty's favorite aphorism. It never always gets worse. We still had the White Mountains to go. Things would surely keep getting worse. They always found a way. The homemade sign I'd seen late last night, while stumbling and sliding in the mud, was probably a more suitable adage. When in doubt, the AT always goes up. I stumbled along with Horty, somewhere between wakefulness and sleep. Horty talked about the latest sleep deprivation research, and how most people could function pretty well on 3.5 hours of sleep, night after night. What mattered most was the quality of sleep. He told me that I could get through this, that I would have to go deeper than I'd ever gone before.
"I've seen you give it everything you had, way back in Irwin, Tennessee, then in Virginia. And now you're going to work harder than you've ever worked in your life. The greater the price we pay, the greater the reward. You can do this, boy."
Jalu and I were set to run the next section across the state line into New Hampshire, 2 distressed peas in a pod. As we slogged through the mud, she told me how hard the previous night had been for her. She told me that she hadn't slept and that, even before that, she'd almost lost it while driving the van up muddy, unmarked logging roads in the fog. She reminded me that I had once promised her she would be the crew chief no matter what, but that last night she'd suggested stopping for the night, and Horty had suggested continuing, and I hadn't listened to her. I was on autopilot, just following the controls that Horty manipulated. I had become occluded to the person who was my lifeblood. I couldn't believe how I had forgotten her. I told her I was sorry, and I was. I choked up, and then began to full-on sob. It was all too much. I couldn't protect Jaylu out here. I couldn't even help her. I was the danger to her. Me and the AT record. I'm sorry. This is crazy. It isn't worth it. Look what I'm doing to you. Look what I'm doing to us, I said between sobs. And in a pleading voice, I muttered, let's just go home. We were exactly 450 miles from Katahdin, only 450 miles from finishing what we had set out to do 1,700 miles back in Georgia. We had come so far and had gotten through so much, yet we had so much more to go. And now, after all that we had been through, I was ready to hang it up. She shook her head, and we kept going. Without her, I would have stopped in Vermont, stuck in the mud.
It was the second time I'd ever seen him cry. He almost never cried. Not when his mother died, not when his friend committed suicide, not when we got married, not when I nearly died. The first time was in April, just 2 months before we wept in each other's arms in the middle of Vermont. We went in for an ultrasound when I was 8 weeks pregnant. It was hard to know what we were looking at on the screen, but we could see the tiny grain of something that we were told was the baby. We were so excited. It had been almost a year since my first miscarriage and ER visit. We were in the middle of final preparations for the Appalachian Trail, where we hoped that our baby would spend its first trimester on its first big adventure. Then the ultrasound tech measured the speck and typed two words, no heartbeat. She didn't say anything. She just went to get the doctor who would review the images with us and deliver the news with more ceremony. But we already knew our dreams were over. At the doctor's office, we were stoic and composed for each other. I tried to be positive, and I said all the things that people always said to me. It wasn't meant to be. It will happen when it's right. Jerker tried to console me, but it wasn't necessary. I was numb to the disappointments by now. When we got home, I lay down on our couch and put my hand over the place where the baby should have been thriving. I felt sick, like I was carrying around an empty promise. Jerker scooted me over and lay down next to me. And then he started crying. Not just crying, but shaking and sobbing. It broke me, and we were suddenly sobbing together over the loss, over our misfortune, over our dwindling hopes of ever having a family. Sometimes it felt like Jerker wanted a baby more than I did. When we first met, I thought he was the quintessential hippie. He certainly exhibited some of the traits. He wore his long curly hair pulled back in a ponytail and always rocked Birkenstock sandals. I'd see him riding his mountain bike all over the hills of Seattle. He didn't own a car. He would take the bus out to Issaquah to train in the mountains. I used to see him shopping at my co-op, Madison Market on Capitol Hill, with his reusable canvas bags filling up on bulk items on Member Appreciation Day when everything was 10% off. He would fill these heavy 5-gallon glass water jugs with reverse osmosis water and haul them back to his studio apartment in a bike trailer. In the early 2000s, he was definitely that quirky vegan guy who seemed so extreme. He was an environmentalist and an idealist. When we started dating, he didn't want to have kids. It's not that he didn't like them, he just didn't need to have his own. His grandparents were foster parents who took care of infants with high needs until they were well enough to be adopted. He grew up changing diapers and swaddling and bottle feeding babies. He had been groomed to be a great father. He just didn't have a desire to be one. At the time, it didn't bother me. I never thought we would get that far anyway. I wasn't even looking for a relationship. In 2007, I had just run my first 100-mile race, and I'd broken up with a long-term boyfriend. The following year, I left my beloved city of Seattle to start the next chapter of my life in Southern California. I was living my dream of designing running clothes for Patagonia, and I wasn't in a state of mind to slow down for anybody. The truth was, even when we became good friends, I felt bad for him. When he was newly single, I set him up with one of my hot climber friends in Seattle who was also recovering from a breakup. When that fizzled, I suggested that he visit me so I could introduce him to my single lady friends in Ventura, but he ended up spending all of his time with me. But we were both transitioning, and neither of us was willing to break stride the way you need to in order to nurture a relationship. And yet we did. Without even trying, we fell in love. By the time we decided to move to Boulder together, in 2010, he'd had a change of heart about kids. The angst he felt about the world was a little softer, and his outlook was a little brighter. The idea of raising a child sounded almost fun. I don't know what it was exactly, and I didn't pressure him. I wasn't even sure I wanted to get married. I think that, in me, he found somebody who appreciated life the way he did, and he wanted to share that same joy with the next generation. But it turns out it's not always that easy. First, he had to have his vasectomy reversed. As an idealistic 30-year-old, he'd been staunchly anti-population growth. 7 years later, he told all his running friends that he'd had a hernia fixed, so he couldn't run for a month. But our close friends knew why he was walking around like he'd just gotten off a horse. One joker opined, "Holy shit, you had your balls cut twice for no reason." Love makes you do crazy things, or undo them. For instance, this. Here we were on day 36, holding each other in the pouring rain in the middle of the woods and sobbing uncontrollably together for the second time in less than 2 months. And like we always do, we put our heads down, leaned into the rain, and kept moving forward. We were physically and emotionally drained at the end of the line. Scott had one last bright idea. Should I call Toph and Kim? It sounded useless. There was no way Topher could break away from his hectic job as the CEO of an outdoor company to help a friend on the East Coast. But we had nothing to lose, so when he found himself hiking alone in the rain, he made a desperate SOS call. Of course, he got Toph's voicemail. "Hey, Toph, I hate to do this to you, but I need you guys to come out here. I know you're busy, but we really need you for the 100-mile wilderness in Maine. Call Jenny and figure out where to meet. The trail is gnarly out here, but you could use the extra mileage. I heard you came up short at Western." Trying to make light of the desperate situation, Jerker jabbed at him for having had to drop out at the Western States 100 a week earlier. We ran into Hanover and crossed our second-to-last state border, going from Vermont into New Hampshire. I went to the Hanover Co-op and loaded up on vegan groceries at this little oasis. The dramatic day didn't end without an absurd final act. That afternoon, somebody took a picture of Jerker sitting by the side of the van. His soaking wet clothes were sagging off his body, his eyes were bulging from the sleepless night, and the photographer applied a filter that made him look even more gaunt than he really was. Then, as the machinery of social media whirred on, someone else snagged that picture and pasted it next to another photo of Scott from day 3. The difference was stark. Of course it was. He'd been running 50 miles a day for weeks. But then another poster, a respected member of the running community, used the cheap photo trick to claim that Scott was wasting away due to his vegan diet. It was amazing how many people had advice for someone they didn't know who was doing something they could never do. I bit my tongue. I had other issues to tend to on Facebook. Somebody had created a fake account using Scott's profile photo, soliciting unsuspecting female fans for money. Strangers were constantly sending me messages, and when I didn't respond, they'd get offended. In what was perhaps divine intervention, I accidentally spilled the contents of my water bottle onto my phone and completely fried it for the remainder of the trip.
Chapter 13. Special Forces. Day 36. It wasn't a hallucination. There really was a chocolate cake on top of the mountain. "Do you think it's for you?" Fat Boy sounded appropriately suspicious. He'd been out on the trail for only a couple of days, so he still had standards of hygiene. I just grabbed it and peeled back the foil. It was still warm. "Of course it's for me." I dug in and devoured it. I told myself it was vegan, and it tasted sufficiently vegan for me not to think too much about it. Godale and I ate the whole thing. He didn't earn the name Fat Boy for being overweight. It was given to him by Horty, of course, after Godale recounted a story from Western States. A runner passed and asked, "Are you Mark Godale?" When he replied yes, the guy seemed puzzled and remarked, "You don't look as fat as you do in Ultra Running magazine." "Aren't we getting close to the road?" "This is the longest 3 miles I've done in my life," he said as we descended from the summit of Mount Cube. He was stating the obvious. The story of my life, every night on the AT. Godale once again had the graveyard shift with me on day 36 in the foothills of the Whites. I knew he had a lot on his mind, but I knew he needed this. He was a real OG from my era, a 7-time 100K World Championship competitor, and he'd held the 24-hour American record before I set a new one in 2010. But he'd been plagued by a series of chronic injuries. Despite his wounds, every April, for the past 24 consecutive years, he had willed himself to complete the Boston Marathon. Years ago, he'd messed himself up running in a slot canyon in Sedona and broken a bunch of bones. He'd undergone many surgeries and was lucky to be alive. But even now, he still half hobbled on the trail and his gait almost twisted him sideways. He was in constant pain, which he was candid about. During easy stretches, I'd ask if he was feeling any better, and he'd inevitably reply, "No, it hurts like hell every step." I sort of appreciated having someone next to me who was as beaten up as I was, if not more. And yet, even with how broken he was, he still took pity on me. As we descended Mount Cube, he remarked that I seemed to be starring in 3 movies at once: Forrest Gump, Groundhog Day, and The Truman Show. The comparisons were painfully spot on. Godale was an excellent partner during a rough couple of nights. He knew when to indulge me and when to push me on. That night, at a particularly narrow corridor of switchbacks with sharp drop-offs on one side, I hit a wall and told him, "I gotta lie down, like now." He said it was a bad place for that, and he was right. But instead of vetoing the idea, he let me lie down, and he stretched his leg out to put something between my body and the cliff in case I rolled over in my sleep. 10 minutes, he said as I closed my eyes. I woke up with a start, panicked. I felt like I'd been out for hours. "Already? Scott, it's been 2 minutes." It didn't matter. We got up and got going. My body had its own clock, and I was at its mercy. It was 2 in the morning when we finally got to the road crossing that I decided would mark the end of the day. Everyone was already asleep, so I crawled into Castle Black, and Mark crammed himself into his car for a few hours of partially reclined rest. Nothing came easy in the live free or die state. Even though we had pushed deep into the night, I hadn't met the mileage goal on the plan Horty had laid out for me. I should have gone another 5 to Lake Tarleton Road, near a town called Warren, but I was finished, and Horty wasn't there to yell at me. I'd nickel and dimed my way back into contention for the FKT, and now I was at risk of nickel and diming my way out again. Day 37 dawned brightly, along with the hope of rebounding before officially entering the Whites. I was greeted in the morning by an old hand, at least at the Appalachian Trail. He had the bravado of a drunken cowboy, loved to mess with my mind, and went by the name of Trail Dog. Think about it. You're 47 miles from Galehead, and lately you've been going 2 miles an hour. That's a 24-hour day, my friend. You won't be done with today until tomorrow. Bet that fucks with your brain a bit. He shot me a cocksure glance and a wink for good measure, and didn't wait for me to respond. No fancy calculus needed out here. Yep, the old AT speed records is simple arithmetic. A harsh math teacher that will bust your balls every time. Man, I fucking love this shit, he said. Trail Dog, a.k.a. Andrew Thompson, was an acolyte of Horty. Once a cocky puppy at Liberty University, whom Horty had brought into his rabid pack of Horton disciples. They did the twisted stuff, like running Horty's 50-mile race course out and back for a fun 100-mile training run. The masochistic professor had taught Thompson well in the arts of extracting pleasure from endless struggle and reveling in the gnar. But most important for me, Trail Dog had set the AT record back in 2005 after a bunch of wild attempts. So he knew what I was going through and what I needed, even if that included a few jabs at me to see how I was holding up. I pressed him for wisdom as we began a day that would involve a 4,000-foot climb to Mount Musilake, the traditional gateway to the White Mountains. The wisdom he shared wasn't exactly the wisdom I wanted to hear, since he noted that I was already behind Horty and Speed Goat's battle plan, and that this day was definitely going to bleed into tomorrow, as my last few nights had. Another graveyard shift finish. Another lonely, broken night. Timmy decided to try to take my mind off the bad news. He made several calls to local contacts. He quipped that it wasn't what you knew, but who you knew that opened doors. He mentioned that he had recruited a running brother of a climbing friend who was willing and able to help us out. I imagined a lanky climber like Timmy, so when Andrew Drummond showed up, I was taken aback. He was at least 6'2" and had the build of Paul Bunyan. He was formidable, and his presence alone boosted my confidence. He seemed capable of dealing with a multitude of difficult scenarios, from grim weather to the gnarliest sections of trail. We could send him in and expect results. Timmy called him Special Forces, which was perfect. As soon as he showed up, he said he was game for an all-nighter in the whites. About 15 miles into the day, Special Forces and I finished our 4,800-foot ascent to the granite plateau atop Mount Musilake, a name that came from the Algonquin word for bald place. For the first time in 1,800 miles, I was above the tree line. The summit was energizing. The sun was shining, and chains of mountains stretched far into the distance. Franconia Ridge was out there, and beyond that, our destination of Galehead Hut. It looked so near. I felt a surge of short-lived optimism. Everything lay at my feet. The whole trail, the whole world. It was the first of many dispiriting illusions of the whites. It's a strange thing, but even though I remember feeling triumphant and optimistic when Special Forces and I summited and then began our descent, I would later hear that this was the point in the journey when I really started to frighten people. Strangers stared at me when I picked up my food with my dirty fingers and shoved it into my mouth. They said I looked like a shadow of myself, a weaker, sicker version. My skin was stretched taut over my cheekbones, and I had grown scraggly facial hair. More than a Heisenberg, but not quite a beard. My high spirits were partly due to the company of my two nearest crewmen and several locals. Special Forces radiated intense adventure, and Trail Dog, well, he was a trip. As we ran, he regaled us with stories about Maniac's winter AT Sobo hike, aided by a bottle of whiskey and a rickety aluminum frame pack. He told us how last summer he'd climbed all 48 of New Hampshire's 4,000-foot peaks in 3 days and 14 hours, beating an 11-year-old record by an hour. He shared tales from the Barclay Marathons, the gleefully perverse Tennessee nightmare that pulls entrance 100 miles through bramble, across raging rivers, and over almost impassable Appalachian terrain, via unmarked paths with nicknames like Ratcha, Hell, and Nunda Utsunni, Cherokee for the trail where they cried. The race began in 1995, and since then, only 15 people have even finished it. Horty was one, Old Trail Dog was another. If a challenge was especially burly, he wanted his name on it. He had attempted FKTs numerous times on the AT, and finally cracked the code going SOBO in 2005. His most impressive accomplishment on the trail to me came on his last attempt. That's when, after he ran the first 200 miles SOBO, fighting his way through Maine, he found that the rivers and creeks he needed to cross were too high to continue. Instead of heading home, he drove straight back to Katahdin, waited a couple days for the rivers to recede, and started over. That sounded utterly mental to me. The Whites were Trail Dog's kind of place. He forged ahead in front of us, through rugged, rocky climbs, and then down into mucky lowlands, where portions of the trail morphed into creeks. As we scaled North Kinsman Mountain, Special Forces pointed out a peak in the distance. The backside of that one is full of the nastiest scree you can imagine. It's just a slippery slide of little rocks, with plenty of trees and brush to crash into. He wasn't complaining. Like Trail Dog, he seemed to get more gleeful as things got rougher. I didn't mind. I just hoped their joyful masochistic wisdom would wear off on me. It was exactly the kind of crazy I needed to finish this thing. 15 miles in, and day 37 was just getting started. I had been on my feet for too much of the past 24 hours, too many of the past 10 days, and I was beginning to display the signs of long-term wear. Horty and Speedgoat had both been explicit in their directions. Get to Galehead Hut the first day in the Whites. They said it would give me a psychological lift, and then shorter daily mileage would ensue after that. I followed orders even though I did notice my mental state had started to warp. Since the Whites were completely foreign to me, I was inclined to cling to whatever concrete advice I had. I needed to start breaking down the remaining and toughest part of the AT into smaller tasks anyway. If I focused on the impossibility of reaching Katahdin within 10 days, I despaired. Focusing on Galehead made things smaller. But I was fading, and day 37 seemed to be whipping by. I wondered what I would do if I didn't make Galehead until sunrise. Would I just keep running? That sounded impossible, and I had to avoid that at all costs. I needed to get to Galehead. I needed to sleep. It wasn't supposed to be like this. As I dreamed this up back home in Boulder, I'd imagined myself getting stronger as I approached Katahdin. Less Bilbo Baggins in Mordor, and more Galahad and the Holy Grail. But that wasn't happening. I wasn't becoming more powerful. Not at all. Instead, I was being stripped down not only of fat, muscle, and nerve, but also of my mental toughness. I was losing it, but maybe that's what I needed to do. At Franconia Notch, I met up with Jalu and the others who had hiked in a mile from the parking lot. We took our time carefully reloading my pack with absolute necessities for hiking through the White Mountains at night. Headlamp, extra batteries, waterproof jacket, additional layers, space blanket, and as many caffeinated calories as possible. Trail Dog was leaving, and all I could hear over the waters of the Pemigewasset River was his proclamation. That's a 24-hour day, my friend. This should have been a flashing red warning light, but the Horty Speedgoat protocol of Galehead or bust had me seeing only green. A less hobbled Timmy cycled back in, and with Special Forces, we all left Franconia Notch in the waning light. Even though I was buoyed by their comedic banter, we soon donned our headlamps to combat the gnarled and rocky terrain, and I felt the sinking repetition of, here we go again, another late, late show finish. I tried to utilize selective amnesia to the many recent 20-hour days, as Frank Shorter rightly claimed that your mind can't know what's coming, in reference to previous marathon trauma. The night took on a surreal quality, as if we weren't consuming only miles and hours, but also mezcal buttons. When we finally reached the ridge of the bald granite mountaintops, it reminded me of a Martian landscape of stark and beautiful stone expanses, with no other earthlings except for three alpine spacewalkers. Holy shit! For the first time, I had dozed off and almost catapulted down the granite trail. I was actually sleepwalking before I suddenly snapped to and caught myself as I slid down a series of cascading routes atop steep stone slabs. Timmy later told me that my movements resembled water sliding down the path of least resistance, as if I had surrendered to gravity. As my trail compatriots traded laugh-out-loud anecdotes and parody songs, I realized how much fun I could have been having. I was like the boy in the bubble. I could see but not actually touch their world. I would laugh to myself in between head bobs. I had no idea what time it was. The hands on my internal clock slowed, then sped up, and I couldn't determine if it was really late or really early. A swirling fog suddenly appeared, as if a genie that had been long straining against its cork had finally wrested himself free from the bottle. It seemed as if the genie were showing me another dimension of the AT, one that would have me losing my mind as I had never done before. And then I heard the tiny, almost secret peeps and chirps emanating from the bushes. Are those the birds? No. I was crushed to hear their songs, which signified the approaching dawn. Even the freaking birds were mocking me. Then over the next hill, we saw it. Galehead. Even though we were close enough to make out the doors and windows, I saw that the way ahead curved down, around, and then back up. That mere mile appeared impassable. No, no way. How? What? I've got to sleep now, I weakly explained as I laid down on a perfectly flat rock. Timmy looked at me like I was crazy. But it's right there. I can't do it. Dude, give me 20 minutes. I pulled my headband over my eyes and instantly fell asleep. Timmy stood over me and thumbed New York Times articles on his phone as special forces went ahead to Galehead. Most likely by the time his head was hitting the pillow, mine was jerking awake. I snapped my head north and almost crowed, "Let's go to Maine." As the sun began to push above the horizon, I rediscovered my body and felt my limbs warm. I remembered how to use them. I remembered why I was there. I forced myself into some semblance of walking and stumbling. I'd been going for about 24 hours. We pushed on, or that's what Timmy told me happened, at least. I don't remember arriving. I have a vague memory of climbing up a giant ladder and Timmy spotting me from below. The bunk beds were stacked five high, and due to our late arrival, the only beds that were available were on the fifth level. I poured myself like wet concrete into the bed, and I heard him saying something about 2 hours. That's it. I slept for 2 hours. And then awoke to the smells of breakfast. Timmy was shaking me. The hut was a small dormitory run by the Appalachian Mountain Club and staffed by college kids, who sang wake-up songs and made tasty meals. One of them played the fiddle. I climbed out of bed, drank some coffee, ate some miraculous oatmeal, put on the same drenched socks and shoes, bade farewell to the young chorus of joy, and then Timmy, Special Forces, and I staggered off. Almost right away, I was on a steep ascent of South Twin Mountain, and soon we were climbing hand over hand, grabbing roots to pull ourselves over rocks and boulders bigger than we were. The rain had stopped, the sun was shining. I'd run all night and into the next morning. For 26 hours straight, with only 2 hours of sleep, I had never felt this beaten.